Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Rachel Heisler with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. We're lucky to have Dr. Keith Hall, Director of the Congressional Budget Office, here with us today. And I'm going to go ahead and first turn the call over to my colleague, Mike Murphy. Mike, you're live.
Thank you, Rachel. And this is Mike Murphy, Chief of Staff at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And I just want to thank you all so much for joining on this call today to participate in a conversation with Dr. Keith Hall, the current director of the Congressional Budget Office. As many of you know, the Congressional Budget Office plays a vitally important role in our policymaking process, providing Congress with objective analysis about the cost and impact of policy proposals and legislation. They do incredibly important work, and we at the committee rely heavily on the information and material they publish throughout the course of the year. That's why we're so honored to have Keith Hall with us today to discuss the history and the role of the CBO. Dr. Hall became the ninth director of the CBO in April of 2015, and he has a distinguished career with more than 25 years of public service, with among his many past positions, including as chief economist at the International Trade Commission, commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, chief of economist at the White House Council of Economic Advisors, among many other positions and accomplishments. So it is our great pleasure to have Dr. Hall with us today. And with that, I'm very happy to hand it over to Dr. Keith Hall. Keith?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Thanks for the opportunity to do this today. I've been looking forward to this. I thought I'd start out by talking a little bit about some things that people should know about CBO. I have a little bit of a list here. First, lawmakers created CBO to give the Congress a stronger role in budget matters. CBO was established under the Congressional Budget Act of 1974 to provide objective, nonpartisan information that would support the budget process. CBO's mission is to help the Congress make effective budget and economic policy. In carrying out that mission, the agency offers an alternative to the information provided by the Office of Management and Budget in the executive branch. Second, the Congress sets CBO's priorities. CBO follows processes specified in statute or developed by the agency in concert with the budget committees and congressional leadership. CBO's chief responsibility under the Budget Act is to help the budget committees with the matters that fall under their jurisdiction. The agency also supports other committees, particularly the Appropriations, Ways and Means, and Finance Committees, and the leadership. Among CBO's statutory requirements is producing certain reports, the best known of which is the Annual Budget and Economic Outlook, which we produced just last month. That report includes CBO's baseline budgetary and economic projections. CBO is also required by law to produce a formal cost estimate for nearly every bill that's approved by a full committee of either the House or the Senate. Those cost estimates are only advisory. They can, but do not have to, be used to enforce budgetary rules or targets. However, CBO does not enforce such budgetary rules, the budget committees do. Third, CBO produces a lot of work every year. For example, in 2017, the agency published 740 formal cost estimates, provided technical assistance to congressional staff as they developed thousands of legislative proposals and amendments, and published many reports about the budget, the economy, and related issues. Nevertheless, because of limited resources, the number of estimates and analyses that CBO can produce falls short of congressional requests. Moreover, the agency must balance its commitment to respond quickly to the Congress with its professional responsibility to release estimates and analysis only when their quality is high enough. Fourth, in order to provide the Congress with the high-quality analysis that it needs, CBO staff has expertise in many areas. Among CBO's roughly 235 people, the largest concentration of expertise is in the area of health. Other areas of focus include national security, labor, taxes, energy, and macroeconomics. Maintaining a broad array of expertise allows CBO to respond to policymakers' needs quickly. Analysts are organized into a number of divisions, but much of CBO's work requires work from more than one division. CBO's analysts always pursue high quality and accuracy. They approach issues with a detailed understanding of federal programs and the tax code. They carefully and critically read the relevant research literature. They painstakingly analyze data collected by the government, statistical agencies, and by private organizations. And they regularly consult with a diverse range of outside experts, including professors, analysts at think tanks, representatives of industry groups and other private sector experts, and government employees at federal, state, and local levels. Some of the consultations occurred during periodic meetings with the CBO's panel of economic advisors and panel of health advisors. Fifth, CBO's analysis is objective, impartial, and nonpartisan. The agency maintains its objectivity in a number of ways. One is that it makes no policy recommendations. Another is that it hires people on the basis of their expertise. Nearly 80% of CBO's employees have advanced degrees, and without regard to political affiliation. The agency carefully considers whether potential analysts can perform objective analysis, regardless of their own personal views, and enforces strict rules to prevent employees from having either financial conflicts of interest and to limit their political activities. CBO aims to reflect the full range of experts' views as it presents the likely consequences of proposals being considered by Congress. The agency's estimates are inherently uncertain, but its goal is to produce estimates that are in the middle of the distribution of potential outcomes. Sixth, models do not produce CBO's estimates. CBO does. CBO's estimates often require projections of how people and institutions would respond to proposed changes in law. A computer model is one tool that analysts may use to make such a projection. There are various kinds of models, such as complex simulation models, regression models, and calculations in spreadsheets. CBO's models are constantly being enriched and improved. Nonetheless, models often cannot show the full scope of the effects of a legislative proposal. Analysts must routinely go further, combining what can be learned from a model with other information so that the estimates correspond as closely as possible to what the best available research suggests. Seventh, CBO has a rigorous system of checks and balances. All of CBO's cost estimates and reports are reviewed internally for objectivity, analytical soundness, and clarity. That process involves many people at various levels in the agency. Analysts' consultations with outside experts help them hear all the perspectives on an issue, and the agency continually revisits its past work and learns from the differences between its projections and actual outcomes. It also compares its analysis to others' work and incorporates outside feedback into its projects. CBO prioritizes transparency. Since its inception, the agency has used many approaches to be transparent. To begin with, CBO's cost estimates and publications include documentation of the basis of their findings. In addition, the agency documents the revisions to its budget projections and estimates. It reports on the accuracy of its projections, including its projections about the economy, spending, revenues, and the health insurance subsidies. It provides analyses of how sensitive its estimates are to key parameters, and it seeks external review of its reports before they are released and of the methods in which the products are based. CBO also promotes transparency by providing broad access. When CBO completes a formal cost estimate, it's made available to all members of Congress, their staff, and the public on CBO's website. Furthermore, CBO's analysts regularly explain their analysis to congressional staff. For instance, in early 2018, in collaboration with the Congressional Research Service, CBO analysts gave presentations to 150 congressional staff members about how CBO develops estimates of health insurance costs and coverage. Unfortunately, the pace of congressional action sometimes limits the time available for providing extensive explanations of estimates. Because the overall demand for CBO's work is high and its resources are constrained, the agency needs to balance requests to explain more about finished analyses with requests for new analysis and with its other responsibilities, such as regularly updating its baseline projections. Ninth, CBO evolves as the needs of Congress evolve. Though CBO has remained true to its original mission, it works with the Congress in ways probably not envisioned when it was first created. For example, as legislation has grown more complex, CBO has found itself spending more time providing preliminary analysis and technical assistance during the drafting stage. And it is being asked more often to prepare cost estimates for bills that are heading for votes without being marked up by committees first. To accommodate Congress's needs and agenda, CBO shifts staffing and develops new analytical tools. For example, the agency devoted significant resources to strengthening its ability to analyze healthcare issues, so it would be prepared for large-scale legislative proposals on that front. Similarly, CBO improved its capability to study how legislative proposals would affect the economy and thus the budget as Congress's desire for such dynamic analysis intensified. And last, CBO is always looking for ways to do things better. For example, CBO was reviewing and updating every aspect of its simulation model of health insurance coverage, which forms the backbone of its budget projections related to federal health care spending for people younger than 65. In addition, CBO will further improve its capability to perform dynamic analysis, as well as its ability to analyze how changes in federal regulations affect the economy and the budget. Responsiveness and transparency are top priorities at CBO, and the agency has plans to bolster them further. It will make greater use of team approaches to handle surges in demand for analysis of particular issues. It will increase the public documentation of its computer models, and it will also do more to explain how analysts employ models while producing estimates. So anyway, that's my little introduction. Happy to answer questions now.
Thanks, Dr. Hall. As many of you know, we did take questions in advance, so I'm going to go through and read some of those questions. The first one is from Meg Hubig at the University of Virginia Center for Politics, and her question was, I have been teaching civics and government for 26 years. How do I explain how the CBO determines the cost of a bill?
Well, hi, Meg. Thank you for your question. First of all, let me say over the past year, we've started producing things that we call explainers that help Congress better understand how we do our work, and one of these was titled How CBO Prepares Cost Estimates, and that can be found on our website. So that has a lot of detail on how we determine the cost of a bill. But let me summarize what it says there. We have a four-step process. First, we carefully read the legislation, fully understand its provisions, with the idea that we're going to assess how it would change current law and what its budgetary effects are going to be. So, of course, this involves a great deal of knowledge about current law and current legislation. Second, we conduct research on the potential effects of enacting the legislation. This involves obtaining timely and balanced information from a broad variety of sources and experts. So we'll call people in academics, the private sector, think tanks, and executive branch agencies. The latter is particularly important, actually, because any piece of legislation needs to be implemented by the executive branch. So we need to have an understanding about how the executive branch agency is likely to implement a new piece of legislation. Third, we analyze and quantify the effects. So we quantify the effects on the federal budget and on mandates for state, local, and tribal governments in the private sector. And that involves using either existing models, developing new models, or simply using basic spreadsheets with data, which involves a little bit of modeling, but it's not very necessarily very complicated. And then last, we communicate the results. So we want to convey the results of the analysis, explain the basis of the estimate. Now, last year, as I mentioned, we did about 740 of these formal estimates. That's a lot, and every one of those are posted on our website. And as I also mentioned, we produce thousands of preliminary informal cost estimates. I think we're somewhere around the range of 10,000 of those. And when we do these estimates, we really kind of have to balance between what I call the due diligence. What I just described is sort of the due diligence of being sure we have an accurate number. Sometimes Congress is in a hurry. Sometimes they're in a very big hurry. And we try to resist that to make sure that we're comfortable with the estimate. So it's a little bit of a balance of things. But the thing we try not to skimp on is this sort of due diligence process that I just described.
Awesome. Thank you. The next question is from from Bill Staton from the Staton Financial Advisors in North Carolina. And his question is CBO effective? If so, how? How do you measure effectiveness?
Well, thank you for the question. We think we are effective. We're an organization full of professionals with lots of education and experience. And I can tell you we're very proud of the quality of our work. In particular, as I mentioned, we really do believe in taking that due diligence and taking our time to not compromise on quality. But as I mentioned, we do a lot of things. So it's really hard to summarize how well we're doing with just one statistic, right? Because we're dealing with we do a lot of things. We're sometimes trying to do them quickly. We're trying to do them completely. We're worried about quality. We're worried about transparency. We're worried about explaining it. So we look at a number of ways. We look at a number of things to measure how effective we are. We get feedback from committee staff. We interact all the time with committee staff, and we try to engage them in getting some feedback after a project is done. Second, I have never yet turned down a request to go to a member's office and talk with a member. You know, whether the member has questions or the member's offering feedback, we want to be able to hear directly from members. Third, we have oversight hearings. And we have at least one a year, although we had more than one this year. But the oversight hearings is a chance for the budget committees to ask us questions about how we did and to give us some feedback on how we're doing. And then last but not least, we do some things for self-evaluation. Every 2 years, we look at our economic forecasting record and sort of see how our economic forecasting worked. And we generally find that our forecasting record is comparable to private forecasters. It's comparable to the administration's forecast. And we also find that when our projections are inaccurate by a large margin, typically all the other forecasters are having trouble as well, because all forecasters are faced with the same challenge. It's hard to predict recessions. It's hard to predict some things. Second thing is we do spending projections. So we evaluate how we do on our spending projections. So our latest one, we look back at over the last 30 years. How well have we done in projecting government spending? Well, we find that for the next budget year, we're off by about 1.7%. And after 6 years, we're off by 3%. So that's awfully accurate, actually, especially when you get out to be 6 years and it's based on an economic forecast that can change dramatically. And we have a similar record with our revenue projections. We look back over the past 30 years. The very next budget year, our revenues are off on average by about only 1.1%. And after 6 years, our projections are off by 5.3%. So we have a number of ways of evaluating how effective we are, and those are some of them.
Awesome. Thank you. The next question is from Jackie Frank with Global Communities, and her question is, does CBO keep track of actual government spending once the appropriations are approved?
Well, thank you for your question. The answer is yes, we do. At the end of every calendar year, we have analysts responsible for each of the budget categories. We have a number of budget categories. They do a self-evaluation with their managers. And the self-evaluation basically asks, how much were we off this year on our forecast and why? And then we have a discussion about what we can change to do better, change assumptions, change the model, and et cetera. So we have this annual analysis of how we did. And we call this, by the way, our analysis of actuals. And for the first time, we decided to make this what used to be a private evaluation public. So for the first time later this month, we're going to release a public version of our analysis of actuals. You can actually see how well we forecast government spending.
Awesome. Thank you. So the next question is from Kevin Kosar, who works at the R Street Institute. And his question is, how many more FTEs would CBO need to score every bill? And if, Dr. Hall, you don't mind touching on what FTEs are, I think that would also be helpful.
Sure. Well, thank you for the question. FTEs refer to full-time equivalents. So it's basically how many full-time people do you have on board. And if you have people who are not fully full-time, you sort of add them together to get full-time equivalents. In a sense, we do this already. The resources we need to square every bill, in a sense, we do this already because we're mandated by statute to produce an estimate of every bill reported out of committee, and we do that. The part where it gets more complicated is for draft legislation or even ideas for legislation, the answer actually winds up being more complicated. And the reason is that we spend a tremendous amount of time offering technical assistance with congressional committees, providing feedback and informal estimates for their ideas and their proposed pieces of legislation. And we spend a lot of time doing that, but we can only do this for committees. We only have the resources to do this for committees. So the tricky part for us is there are many members of Congress who have ideas or even draft pieces of legislation that they'd like us to look at. And in fact, there's quite a lot of them that have that request, and we have nowhere near the staff to help. We have nowhere near the staff to sort of help all the members of Congress with this. So we have to focus just on the committees. So one of the things that's going forward, we've gotten feedback about trying to do the Congress would like to do estimates faster, and to provide more transparency. So we are making a budget request to add about 20 additional FTEs over the next few years to see if we can improve upon our speed and improve upon our transparency. But part of that hopefully will be to provide more assistance to individual members. So maybe we'll get a chance to give more feedback on legislation for other members. But it's nowhere near enough for us to meet the complete demand for our assistance on draft legislation.
Thanks, Dr. Hall. The next question is from former Congressman David Mingy, who's a CRFB board member too. And his question is, what has CBO concluded about the dynamic effects of the 2017 tax bill?
Well, again, thank you for your question. Let me first just say that the staff of the Joint Committee on Taxation, they're the ones who are tasked with providing estimates for proposed tax legislation before a congressional vote. And on the 2017 tax bill, they did a great job, and their analysis did include an analysis of the dynamic effects, as you're asking. But we also did that when we produced our budget and economic outlook that we released last week. We also took a look at the tax bill and did our own analysis of the effect of the tax, the dynamic effects of the tax bill. And literally for both JCT and CBO, we found that the level of economic output over the next 10 years would be on average 7/10 of a percentage point higher each year over the next 10 years. So we do have a higher level of economic output over the next 10 years because of the tax bill. And we also provided something that we don't usually provide, something interesting, I think, particularly interesting. We provided a table where we collected up 8 different estimates of the tax bill, 6 by private organizations, 1 by CBO, 1 by JCT. And those estimates, of those 8 estimates, 7 range from 3/10 to 7/10 of a percentage point in GDP. So CBO and JCT were right there, maybe at the upper end of that. One estimate was a bit of an outlier. It estimated that the level of GDP would be 2.1 percentage points higher per year over the last 10 years. And maybe let me put it a different way. The tax cuts, we think, will add to the deficit directly, but the stronger growth induced by the tax cuts will reduce the deficit. So you have these two competing forces. So you have the positive growth effect on the budget from the higher from the tax cuts, and you have the negative effect from the tax cuts themselves. We found that the growth effect on the budget was about 1/3 of the budget loss from the tax cuts themselves. So a phrase you often hear is, will tax cuts pay for themselves? We found the tax cuts pay for about 1/3 of themselves.
Thank you. The next question is from Stuart Greenfield with Austin Community College. And his question is, according to the NBER, there has been at least one recession per decade. There has been no recession since June of 2009, and your quarterly annual RGDP project, presumably projections, are all positive, even though they do decline to around 1.5%. Knowing it's not the easiest thing to forecast, but not to have a recession for 20 years seems somewhat out of the box. So I think that's a question he'd like you to comment on.
Okay. Perhaps. Well, first, thanks for your question, and I absolutely agree that recessions are not easy to forecast, maybe impossible. But in a sense, we do forecast recessions. What we did is we look back over the last 50 years, and we find that if you look at GDP growth relative to potential GDP growth, potential GDP growth is sort of a full employment level GDP growth, that actual GDP growth averages about 1/2 of a percentage point below potential over the past 50 years. And the reason it's below is because of recessions. So the effects of recessions historically have lowered potential growth, have lowered actual growth 1/2 a percentage point below potential. So if we ignored that fact and just pretended there would be no recessions going forward, we'd give Congress an inaccurate forecast of the budget. So we put that into our forecast. We actually, when we have GDP getting up to its potential, we actually don't put in the full level of potential growth. We put in a level of growth that's 1/2 a percentage point below potential. So in a sense, a recession's always in our forecast, but we just don't know when or if it'll actually occur, but it's actually in our forecast.
Thank you, Stuart, for your question. And there's one more question, Dr. Hall, and it's from Ralph Sonshine at American University. And his question is, I believe that we have a looming budget crisis as the baby boomers hit their last years of life starting in the mid-2020s, circa 2026 or 2028. Please comment on this view given our budget trajectory.
Well, again, thank you for your question. We certainly document what we see happening with respect to the budget going forward. We just released our updated economic and budget projections last month. And it's a forecast under current law, and we pretty clearly show that there are some significant budget challenges for the U.S. over the next 10 years and beyond. I wouldn't want to characterize it as a crisis or not, but we certainly have some significant challenges. Accumulated debt is about 78% of GDP. That's a really high level. Give you an idea of that, right before the Great Recession, debt was already pretty high, and it was 35% of GDP. We see under current law that deficits will rise significantly over the next few years and settle in at about 5% of GDP. Those are deficits, and that will add to the debt. So we see the debt, the accumulated debt, rising to nearly 100% of GDP by 2028. And 100% of GDP sounds like a big number, and it is. It's the highest since the end of World War II. It's debt accumulating at a time when the economy is at basically full employment right now. If one were serious perhaps about reducing the debt going forward, this would be a good time to run a surplus, not run higher deficits. And of course, the problem comes from some three things right now. Debt is already very, very high, so when interest rates go up to more normal levels, cost of servicing that debt's going to go way up. We have an aging population, as you mentioned, with baby boomers. And then we have fast-growing health care costs. Those last two things are going to be a significant challenge for federal spending going forward and will add significantly to that debt. And if that's not a stark enough picture over the next 10 years, in July we'll produce our annual long-term budget outlook where we look at the trajectory of the budget over the next 30 years rather than the next 10 years. Last year's number saw the debt-to-GDP ratio hitting about 150% of GDP after 30 years, and we'll have to update that this year. But 150% of GDP would be well above the highest level of debt the United States has ever had. I think the record for the United States is something like 104% of GDP. And again, that was right after World War II at a very different time period than we are right now. So we have really significant budget challenges going forward. I absolutely agree with that.
Dr. Hall, thank you so much. I'm going to turn the call back over to Mike Murphy from CRFB, who's going to wrap things up. But if anybody on the call ever has a question, please feel free to reach out to me. And CRFB is happy to answer any questions moving forward, too. But, Mike, why don't you close out the call? And, again, everyone, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Rachel. I'll just close once again by thanking Dr. Hall so much for his participation today, and thank you all for joining us. We hope you found it as informative as we did to learn more about the important work being done by the CBO. And you can learn more about the CBO by going to their website at cbo.gov. and finding their many, many, many reports, as Dr. Hall mentioned. So thank you all again for joining us. Thank you, Dr. Hall. And with that, we will conclude the call. Thank you all for joining, and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Mike.